what you'll find is the first half of Revelation, to me, is a whole lot easier to explain, a whole lot easier to get through. Once we kind of come up to this area tonight, starting in chapter 12 up to about chapter 18, it gets tough. If we haven't been talking solely about future stuff yet, we're kind of starting to bleed into that area now, perhaps. Maybe the whole thing is future, and we've just been considering the possibility that it's not. But I would remind you again, you know, as we shared at the very beginning of the course, we have to be careful not to get into the habit of just reading Revelation as though it unfolds chronologically. Apocalyptic literature doesn't work that way. It doesn't follow the same rules as narrative, as story, because it's not a narrative. It's not a story. It's a series of visions that John has, and he's recounting them to us. And so we've seen seven seal, the book opened that reveals what's to come. We've seen seven trumpets blown, which are, I read recently a description that talked about this, the seven seals as being just the natural outworkings of human sin, where seven trumpets really usher in the new concept of God pouring out judgment on creation for the purpose of warning people, calling people to repent. The imagery in Revelation being a little bit different, but that concept is full. The Old Testament is full of it. That's what most of our prophetic writings are, that before God sends the Babylonians to destroy Jerusalem, he sends numerous prophets to warn them, to call them to repent, to warn them that judgment is coming, and give them an option or an opportunity to stave off judgment. And so that whole idea of warning people, judgment is coming, repent now, is a common concept from the beginning of Scripture to the end of Scripture. It's just that the clothes that it wears here in Revelation is very different than what it wears in the Old Testament. Did y'all look at the seventh trumpet 2 weeks ago? Garrett couldn't remember if he covered. He knew that y'all talked about the witnesses and mainly chapter 10 and 11. Yeah, the angel and the little scroll and then the two witnesses. The two witnesses, clearly, it's imagery designed to connote Moses and Elijah in our mind. And so some have said, well, literally, this is Moses and Elijah come back. Others have said, no, it's two others, two literal people designed that are given the power of Moses and Elijah. And then there are those that would say, well, two witnesses represents the entire people of God that have the power and access, the same God that filled Moses to accomplish his deeds and Elijah to accomplish his deeds fills the witnesses to God today. The reason being why there are two witnesses is because according to the Old Testament laws, in order for an accusation or a testimony to stand up in court, it could not rest on the testimony of one, but had to rest on the testimony of two. Yeah, had to be two witnesses. And so it's a nod towards the Old Covenant, the laws of the Old Testament, as well as two of the most power-filled, spirit-filled figures from the Old Testament. We move to chapter 12. We're done with the seventh trumpet, which is at the end of chapter 11. And you'll notice, if you guys didn't last week, just like the seventh seal, the seventh trumpet, it kind of has this feeling of finality, doesn't it? It feels like, is this the end? Well, if Revelation is chronological, it's not. But if the seventh trumpet kind of lines up at the end, if the seventh seal lines up at the end, they may have different beginning points, but they may have the same ending points. The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he will reign forever and ever. The 24 elders were seated on their thrones before God. They fell on their faces and worshiped God. Verse 19, God's temple in heaven was opened, and within his temple was seen the ark of his covenant. There came flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, an earthquake, and a great hailstorm. So perhaps the end, perhaps it's just marking a new moment in the progression of these stages moving towards the end. We get to chapter 12, really 12, 13, and 14. We're going to cover these three chapters over 2 weeks. And so we'll have our we'll get into 13, although I didn't give you notes for that. And then when we get to our last cycle of seven is chapter 16. So those will be coming up after Easter. 12, 13, and 14 it's kind of like this cosmic drama. If you were to go to the theater, John, from his perspective, watching this vision unfold, recounts what he sees by identifying characters in a play, and they have roles to play, and he's telling us the story of what he sees. And especially in chapter 12, really what it is a war. So this is, Homer's The Iliad or The Odyssey, probably more The Iliad, which was more of a war story than The Odyssey, which was a travel story. It's a biblical version of that. It's a war that moves from the heavens to the earth, kind of back and forth, war that plays out over centuries, we believe. And the characters sometimes are hard to pinpoint, and the movements of it may be hard to identify specifically. Maybe they represent singular events, or maybe these things represent cycles of events that happen over and over again. But it's clear that there's a war taking place. We go back into Paul's writings, and Paul talks about spiritual warfare. We go back into the Gospels, and Jesus talks about enemies and about spiritual warfare. In the garden, the disciples are falling asleep. He talks about warfare. And these three chapters are perhaps the most creative and most in-depth picture of this spiritual war between the enemies of God and the people of God. But it's not as clearly defined, perhaps, as we would like for it to be. And so I have to approach this looking at broad trends, broad ideas, as opposed to specific ideas. Because when we get focused in looking for specific examples in our time, in our day, it's very easy for us to miss the ball. You know, if you're playing baseball and you strike one and strike two and strike three, this is where you find in the bargain bin at every Christian bookstore all the books that have been written over the last 40 years that guessed on what all these specifics were, and time has come and gone, and they weren't correct. And so now, instead of paying $20 for those books, you pay 20 cents for those. Or, you know, church members will come and leave them on the carrel out by the library, and you can take them and add them to your library of failed prophecy collection if you'd like. Broad pictures, and then once you understand the broad pictures, all of a sudden you see types all throughout the history of the church. You see types even in our own day. But I think that's more the point, is to depict a general atmosphere of what the interrelation is going to be between the people of God, the enemies of God, God himself in heaven, from whenever Jesus ascends to whenever Jesus returns. And we clearly are living in the in-between period. Jesus has ascended. We're waiting for Jesus to return, whenever that might be. Let's start chapter 12. It says, "A great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head." There's some notes written on your page, but let's just talk about them as we come to them, because we start learning how to pick up on some of this symbolic language. Clothed with the sun is, you know, it's normally imagery to the sun pertains to its brightness, its radiance. The moon under her feet speaks to some kind of dominion or rule. Anything being under the feet of somebody speaks to dominion or rule. And 12 stars on her head. The number 12 doesn't appear as much in Revelation as the number 7 and 10, but it does crop up every now and then. And the number 12 almost always causes us to think of the people of God. Yeah, the people of God, whether it's the Old Covenant people of God in the form of 12 tribes, whether it's the New Covenant followers of Jesus represented by 12 apostles. The number 12, it should automatically cause us to think of something more holistic, perhaps. And, you know, the people of God, not defined by Israel, not defined by the church, but defined by those from the beginning of Revelation, not the book of Revelation, but God's revelation in Scripture, those who would be the true people of God. And we know from the Old Testament that not all who were ethnically Jewish were part of the true people of God. And we know from the New Testament that not all who call themselves members of churches are part of the true people of God. But we know that in both of those entities, there are many who are known as sons and daughters of God. And so, without going any further on identifying this woman, she clearly has something to do with the people of God. It says, verse 2, that she was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his heads. A dragon. You keep reading, and this chapter is going to clearly identify the dragon for us as Satan. But even before we get that far, if you go back into the Old Testament, you find all of these kind of fantastical beasts. Long before there was a Harry Potter movie called Fantastic Beasts, there were leviathans and behemoths and Tiamats and Rahavs in the Old Testament, all these monsters that we can't really identify, but that represented just kind of evil or chaos or that which stands against God. And so the dragon, it's clearly what it's depicting, it's pointing out. The number 7 is complete. 7 heads would seem to imply that it's very wise or very knowledgeable, complete wisdom or knowledge. 10 horns, horns are power, strength, whether it's a bull or whether it's a rhino or whether it's a apocalyptic, fantastic creature. Horns identify with power. 7 and crowns represent authority, reign or rule. Here, we talked about in the letters how the crowns that were given, I believe, to the church at Ephesus is the word Stephanos, the word for the victor's wreath. And I told you there's another word for crown, the diadem, which is more the crown of rule, not a crown of victory. And here is the beginning of where we start seeing the diadems appear. Same word in English. We don't have a differentiation between the victor's crown and the ruler's crown. But the dragon has clearly claimed authoritarian rule and operates from that position. It says that the dragon's tail swept 1/3 of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that he might devour her child the moment it was born. She gave birth to a son, a male child who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. Because we've been going through the 7 letters on Sunday mornings, this is an image that you should have in your brain relatively fresh from just a couple of weeks ago, because that was the promise given to the church at Thyatira, I believe, is that they would also have that they would rule with an iron scepter. We've seen it a couple of times in Revelation. It points to the shepherd's rule. Not that the whole thing was made of iron, but shepherds would have a wooden staff, and on the end would normally be kind of a cap made out of iron that they could use for fighting off wild animals. And so when it talks about rule of an iron scepter, it's talking about the rule of a shepherd more so than the rule of a giant monster. Rule of compassion and kindness and gentleness instead of rule of oppression and violence. She gave birth to a son, a male child. It says her child was snatched up to God and to his throne, and the woman fled into the desert to a place prepared for her by God where she might be taken care of for 1260 days, a number which represents 3.5 years, I believe, if you're doing quick math. Let's stop here at verse 6. The 3 characters that have been introduced, the woman, the child, and the dragon, all right? If we start with the child I think is fairly easy to identify. There's not a lot of debate or argument here. The child clearly appears to be the Messiah. It's Jesus, that he was born, that he would rule like a shepherd, that the dragon sought to devour him, that before he could, the son was snatched up into heaven to take his place on his throne. And so I think we're fairly safe. There's not a whole lot of places in Revelation where we can kind of plant our flag and say we're 99% confident we have it here. But in this instance, the child appears to be Jesus. Fair enough. Number two, the dragon is also, I think, fairly easy to identify. Let's read 7, 8, 9 real quick. It says, "There was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back, but he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down," and then it gives five names: the ancient serpent, called the devil, or Satan, who leads the whole world astray, or who deceives. He was hurled to the earth, and his angels with him. And so, again, if we're unsure about the dragon, the chapter really doesn't leave it too much to mystery here. It says Satan, the ancient serpent of old, the devil, the one who deceives. The challenge is we so like to personify Satan in our storytelling culture. It goes back, to Dante's Inferno, to John Milton, to Looney Tunes, to Halloween, to our little red dragon with pointy horns and a pitchfork and a tail. We like to personify this. Whatever Satan is, it's a spiritual entity, much like the angels. Is a spiritual entity. And here, it seems to be kind of casting a really wide net and saying, look, whatever, whoever he is, his presence has been identified from the very beginning, the ancient serpent of old. He's identified as the accuser. The name Satan really, we put a capital S here. We do that in the Old Testament as well. And in Hebrew, it's not a proper name. It's an adjective or a title, much like a cupbearer and a chief baker. In Joseph's case, the Satan was the accuser, almost like he had a role to play in the heavenly courts. It's one of the great mysteries, not great mysteries, but one of the challenges of interpretation of the book of Job is the Satan. That's one of the places where the title is given in the Old Testament, HaSatan, the accuser, seems to have access to the court of God, seems to have an audience with God, as though his responsibility is to go out and observe people, especially those who profess to be believers in God, and test them or challenge them or accuse them for where they fall short of God's laws. And so from Job all the way through the end, this is one of the roles that this personification plays. It's the tempter or the deceiver. He's the accuser. The one here, the one who leads the whole world astray, speaks to his role of deception. It's one of the most perplexing challenges we have as in the church. It's less speaking out against Satanists as it is speaking out against people who call themselves Christians but clearly do not represent Christ either with their word or their deed. Which causes more damage in the world today? It's the latter. It's those that call themselves Christians but really lead people astray by calling themselves Christians and turning people against the church, against God, because they represent a bad example. This whole idea of deception, clearly, if you were the enemy of God, what do you think would be a better strategy? Creating a whole religion based on evil and wickedness, or carving out a place within the people of God and then making it look very different than what it really is, making it look nasty, making it look selfish or greedy or oppressive. And then you think back to the history of the Christian church. This is the story of Christianity, is all of the good, benevolent, kind, compassionate things the church has done, coupled with all of the atrocious, warfaring, horrible things that the church has done. They exist side by side. And while some people would look at all the horrible things and say, that's why I don't believe in God, or that's why I don't want to have anything to do with Christianity, other people would look at all of the great things the church has done and say, yeah, but what about these? I think that whole dynamic over the last 2,000 years of Christian history speaks to the devil's primary attempt at deceiving people from within the Christian church. More so, now granted, he does from outside too. That's not his only strategy. But especially in our country, which has been predominantly Christian for so long, this is the strategy that works most effectively. You can go into some lesser developed parts of the world that are still oppressed a lot by tribal religion, tribal beliefs, ancestor worship, things like that. That's deception as well. And so his repertoire is very widespread. But for us in America, his chief mode of deception seems to be character assassination of the Christian church. So, the child, the dragon, we'll call the dragon Satan, just because that's typically the name we give him, and that's who we identify him. Or we could just call him the dragon. That's kind of what Revelation does. It identifies him just with that title alone. So, thoughts or questions about the child or about the dragon up to this point before we turn to the woman? Because the woman is a little tougher. Yeah.
There's a lot of this story
in the stars. That's interesting. Yeah. His comment about constellations and astronomy, that this story is maybe written not just here in the pages of Revelation, but maybe in the cosmos as well. So, the woman, when you read this, see, here's how we, apocalyptic literature, it kind of baits you and then switches, because the first time you read this, you hear about a woman and she's giving birth and she gives birth to a child, and we identify the child as Jesus, and so we think of the woman and identify the woman to be perhaps Mary. Yeah. She's represented here as an individual, as a singular, but as we keep going, especially as we get down into verse 13, it says, when the dragon saw that he had been hurled to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. The woman was given the two wings of a great eagle so that she might fly to the place prepared for her in the desert where she would be taken care of for a time, times, and half a time, which is it's believed to be another figurative way of speaking about 3.5 years, the same 1,260 days we saw previously. And the serpent tries to overtake the woman and sweep her away. The earth helped the woman by opening its mouth. There's something a little bit bigger and more dramatic taking place here. If the woman is just Mary, then a lot of this outflowing of the war that takes place doesn't seem to fit. Mary seems to be the woman seems to be a little bit more of a corporate entity than it does just an individual person. We identified her already with 12 stars, and so in some capacity she represents the people of God. And so you see on your notes there, there have been elaborate arguments made to suggest that Mary represents the Old Covenant people, the Old Testament Israel, that she represents Israel, period, in any time or any place, that she represents a combination of Israel and the church. There have been those that have tried to say that she represents the church, although that is for reasons you'll see at the end of the chapter. After the woman escapes, verse 17, it says, the dragon went off to make war against the rest of her offspring. And so the church alone doesn't get a whole lot of attention identified with the woman, if not the church coupled with Israel. One of the broadest descriptors that's given is that the woman represents the true messianic community, which is broad and maybe unsatisfactory, but it's an answer that people give whenever they really don't, when none of the other more specific puzzle pieces can be completely defended, I suppose. So we could do strengths and weaknesses of all of these, but let's dialogue a little bit just about what you see when you think of that, when you read this. If we follow just the events taking place here, there's a war in heaven. The dragon is making war in heaven. Michael and his angels fight against him. We don't know the timing of this. That's part of the challenge. Is this during the crucifixion, during the death of Jesus? Is this after the resurrection of Jesus, this heavenly battle? Some have said this is a war maybe earlier in time, back whenever Satan originally fell. Maybe this is looking further back into, you know, the time of Genesis or the time of Exodus or something Old Testament. Is this not talking about the first time that Satan and his angels fell, but maybe an attempt around the time of Jesus for them to reclaim their spot amongst the heavens? Timing eludes us here. It doesn't give us any kind of timing. But the dragon makes war in the heavens against the heavenly beings and loses, is thrown to the earth. When he comes back to the earth, it says that he makes war with the woman. The woman escapes, and then the dragon goes out to make war with the rest of the woman's offspring. So that is... that's kind of the trajectory that we're trying to trace here. You had your hand raised, Ricky. Did you have a comment or thought? Yes. Israel. Yeah. I'll tell you, I think when you get to the end of chapter 12 and the dragon is going off to make war with the rest of her offspring, the rest of her offspring I've seen identified as Gentile believers, especially if the woman is identified as Israel. Some have looked at this as a timing point of view. They would say that the woman is the spiritual Israel up to the point of Jesus being born. They would say it's Old Covenant, Old Testament Israel. And the offspring of that Old Covenant Israel that related to God through the law, that gave birth to the Messiah, the rest of her offspring would then be all of those, whether they're Jew or Gentile, that come to God through the new covenant, which is the blood of Christ. I kind of like that latter one, but I don't know that I've thought it through fully. There may be holes that you could poke in that line of thinking. But I do think because you have the woman and then you have the rest of her offspring, while this is the people of God, there's some kind of division here. There's something that separates the woman from the rest of her offspring within this community of faith or people of God. Yes?
The offspring, in some ways, I think of also non-believers.
Yes?
Satan uses non-believers. I mean, he uses us, humans, as you think of him as our friend.
Yeah. Could be the deceived, in other words. Yeah, quite possibly. I'm jumping around here, but since you mentioned deception there, if you look in verse 15, the woman was given wings. She was taken to a place prepared for her in the desert. Then verse 15, it says, from his mouth the serpent spewed water like a river to overtake the woman and sweep her away with the torrent. But the earth helped the woman by opening its mouth and swallowing the river that the dragon had spewed out of its mouth. In an attempt to destroy the woman, flying away on wings like an eagle, the dragon spews some torrent like a river. Doesn't say it is a river, but like a river. And the most common interpretation of that image that I've seen is the deceptions of the dragon, whether it's false teaching or false doctrine or false religion. It's his efforts to deceive, and in doing so deceive some. But of course here we have the earth aiding in the escape of the woman. So, listen, lots of images, lots of pictures. And I told you before, a lot of times we can go back into the Old Testament or even into first century Jewish literature and find lots of examples. There's a very well-crafted and very sensible explanation that talks about the Palestinian or the Jerusalem church fleeing Jerusalem prior to Rome coming in 70 AD and destroying the temple and destroying the city. That perhaps this was part of the Messianic community fleeing from judgment or destruction or fleeing from Rome. We know Rome, it's surely not the totality of the dragon, but we know that Rome at that time was encompassed in the idea of the dragon. And that when you have the Christian church or some of the, you know, the Messianic Jews or just some of the more holy and righteous Jews living there, that lots fled into the desert, fled into Qumran, fled into Masada, fled into, you know, other parts of the desert prior to Rome landing on the city. And but the trick is with this torrent, river-like torrent, there really is no precedent for that to help us out anywhere, Old Testament or perhaps the only example would be that going into the wilderness ought to draw up images of what? The woman being secured. It's referenced both before the refrain and after. Verse 6, the woman fled into the desert to a place prepared for her by God. And then here she's given wings that she might fly to a place prepared for her in the desert where she would be taken care of. Going into the desert, that should draw images. One big one, which is 40 years in the wilderness, Exodus, yeah. There's also, but that's not the only one. We also kind of have Jacob having to leave Egypt and go into the far country where his uncle Laban lived before he was able to come back. We also have Elijah under persecution from Jezebel having to flee into the desert and hide in a cave, and God feeds him with the ravens. It's a cyclical metaphor of God. The desert wasn't a place of punishment. It was a place of safety in all of those accounts, and a place of provision. The wilderness only became a place of punishment because the Israelites refused to go into the land. It was only supposed to be a short stay in the wilderness. It turned into a much longer one because of their obstinacy. Yes? So that was my point, was this torrent sweeping people away. If there's a paradigm anywhere, it would be the crossing of the sea, you know, potentially wiping away the Israelites, but didn't. Instead, it swept away the Egyptian army, Pharaoh's army, and the Israelites were secured safely to the other side. That may be stretching the imagery a little bit, but it does connect with the desert imagery, and it's connected in some way. In that case, the waters were a source of deliverance. Here, they seem to be a weapon of the enemy, but a lot of moving parts. Right? And so that's why for me it's easiest to think of these three main characters. We have Jesus, we have the dragon, we have the woman and her offspring, which in totality represents the people of God, I think, with some division, whether it's a division of time, whether it's a division of Israel and the church, whether it's a division of covenant, old covenant, new covenant. The problem is the text doesn't really give us any other clues. This is where people start going to look for historical events. So where was it that Israel might have been sequestered for 3.5 years or for a small period of time where they were protected or guarded? Maybe during the Roman siege of Jerusalem in 70. Maybe some other point in the history. People have looked at this and, you know, talked about the reestablishment of the nation of Israel in our lifetime, in recent history. Or people look here at something still future, yet to happen. A war that might be coming on Israel and a season of protection or safety that is yet to take place. At this point, we kind of enter into the guessing game, which I don't like going there. People that interpret Revelation love going there, but I tend not to. So, Let's read Daniel chapter 7, because I think it lends some insight into this as well. It's clearly, with the horns and the dragon, it's clearly the imagery John is drawing from. If you're not as familiar with the book of Daniel, the first half of Daniel is narrative. The second half of Daniel is visions, apocalyptic, much like Revelation is. For me, the easiest way to understand Daniel big picture is it is a, what we're transitioning out of Old Testament and moving towards New Testament. And in much of the Old Testament, God's interactions has been with ethnic Israel, national Israel. And granted, there's lots of cases to Jonah going to Nineveh and Elijah going, healing Naaman, the Canaanite, or going to the widow of Zarephath. There's Ruth, the Moabitess. There's lots of hints that God is the God of all nations and the people of God eventually will be comprised of all nations. But Daniel is written kind of as a prophetic bridge between the Old Testament and New Testament. And so you can almost chop it up into four segments. God exemplifying his sovereignty over Babylon, which was the world power ruling over Israel. That's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, King Belshazzar, the fiery furnace. Then God exemplifying his sovereignty over the next world empire after Babylon, which was, anybody? Persia. Yeah, that's King Darius in the lion's den. Those were both in the time frame of Daniel, and so we get stories, we get narrative. But then we move into the future, and so we don't get stories, we get prophetic visions. But the next section is God exemplifying his sovereignty over the next major world empire, which would be Greece. Yeah, Alexander the Great. And then the next world empire, which would be Rome. Yeah. You can almost carve Daniel up into four. One, two, three, four. And it goes Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. And at the end, it kind of bleeds Rome into something that feels a little bit more cosmic or holistic or spiritual. You know, something that's a little bit bigger even than these four, if you will. But here in chapter 7, we're in the third segment. We moved into the prophecies away from the narrative. And so Daniel's vision says, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream. Vision passed through his mind as he was lying on his bed. He wrote down the substance of the dream. He said, in my vision at night I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven, churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came out of the sea. The first was like a lion, had wings of an eagle. We got wings from an eagle in Revelation 12. I watched till its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground, so it stood on 2 feet like a man. With the heart of a man was given, a heart of a man was given to it. There before me was a second beast which looked like a bear, raised up on one of its sides. It had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. I was told, get up and eat your fill of flesh. After that I looked, there before me was another beast that looked like a leopard. On its back it had four wings like those of a bird. After that in my vision, there before me was a fourth beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. Rome was the city built on 10 hills. That is one among several clues that causes us to identify these four beasts with the four empires we just mentioned. A lion, Babylon, a bear, Persia, a leopard. The empire that spread like lightning, and then its leader, Alexander the Great, died in his mid-30s, and then it became fractured and divided amongst different people and ultimately gave way to Rome, which was surpassed all of the other three. But this last beast, it has 10 horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and three of the first horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth that spoke boastfully. And as I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow, the hair of his head was white like wool, His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. It's a little heavenly vision, long before John's visions in Revelation. Daniel has one of the throne here. He says, then I continued to watch. Because of the boastful words, he's usually just referred to as the little horn. There was 10, and a small one comes up and uproots 3 others. The little horn, because of the boastful words he was speaking, I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority, but were allowed to live for a period of time. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. The rest of the chapter, Daniel says, I was troubled in my spirit. The visions that passed through my mind disturbed me. You don't say. I approached one of those standing there and asked him the true meaning of all of this. And so he told me and gave me the interpretation of these things. The 4 great beasts are 4 kingdoms that will rise from the earth. But the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. Then I wanted to know the true meaning of the 4th beast, which was different from all the others and most terrifying, with iron teeth and bronze claws, the one that crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. I wanted to know about the 10 horns on its head and the other horn that came up before which 3 of them fell. Verse 12, as I watched, this horn was waging war against the saints and defeating them until the Ancient of Days came and pronounced judgment in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came when they possessed the kingdom. He gave me this explanation. The 4th beast is a 4th kingdom that will appear on earth. It will be different from all the other kingdoms and will devour the whole earth, trampling it down and crushing it. The 10 horns are 10 kings who will come from this kingdom. After them, another king will arise different from the earlier ones. He will subdue 3 of them. He will speak against the Most High and oppress his saints and try to change the set times and the laws. The saints will be handed over to him for a time, times, and a half a time, a year, 2 years, and a half a year. That's the interpretation of the language being given there. 3.5 years, in other words. But the court will sit, his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be handed over to the saints, people of the Most High. The kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, etc., etc. This is the end of the matter. I, Daniel, was deeply troubled by my thoughts, and my face turned pale, but I kept the matter to myself. There are perhaps some other connections to Revelation in Daniel chapter 8, which you can read there. But here we've got... The first trick is figuring out what Daniel 7 is talking about, because we need to know what Daniel 7 is talking about to know what John is referring to when he's using Daniel 7 in Revelation 12. And interpreting Daniel 7 is no easy feat. It's not plainly obvious. One very common story that's used and usually connected to this, after the death of Alexander the Great, the Greek Empire was divided up into, I believe, 5 different regions, and 5 different commanders were given reign. We know a lot about the history from the apocryphal writings that the Catholic Bible has, that the Protestant Bibles do not, because the books of the Maccabees tell some of the Jewish history of this period between the Testaments, the Old Testament, New Testament. And of those 5 regions, one was based in Egypt, and one was based in what is now Syria, Antioch. And so you had basically one to the north of Israel and one to the south of Israel. And those two waged war over the land of Israel, just like Babylon and Egypt had for centuries before. Originally, the land of Israel was given into the control of the Egyptian which were their rulers were referred to as the Seleucids, and so the Seleucid Empire had control of Israel. But upon the death of the first, the rulers in Syria, who were referred to as the Ptolemies, thank you. Seleucids were in Antioch. Thank you. Ptolemies in Egypt, Seleucids. I was thinking the Antiochians, but that's not right. The ruler himself in reference is referred to as Antiochus Epiphanes. And with the Syrian government taking over the reign of Israel, this particular governor, Antiochus Epiphanes, was incredibly anti-Semitic. Took over Jerusalem, set up temples to the pagan gods in the temple of the Lord, sacrificed a pig on the altar of the Lord, made it illegal for Jews to practice their religion, put to death many practicing Jews. This is all taking place year 300s, 3rd century BC, perhaps. My history is not exactly right. The Maccabean War is 150? 186, yeah. Well, the Maccabean independence, yes. Yeah. Probably 200s then, the time of Antiochus. But anyways, Antiochus Epiphanes is one of these enemies. I mean, Israel and the people of God have enemies from Pharaoh to Nebuchadnezzar to, to Jezebel. I mean, they're lined up throughout Scripture. But this is one of those enemies of the people of God that just kind of has risen above many others. It's just his horrible nature, his viciousness against the people of Israel. And in prophetic writings, many people think what Daniel's referencing here, the small horn that rises up, may be referring to him, in which case John's use of this imagery of horns, of Rome, of Antiochus, may be speaking to some kind of enemy of the people of God of a similar capacity that will come later on. The challenge with that is that you saw the small horn comes up during what we generally interpret to be the beast that is Rome, not the beast that is Greece. And so that creates a little disconnect, perhaps. Writings on Revelation have loved to try and identify the 10 emperors of Rome that represent the 10 most persecution-oriented periods towards the church during the Roman Empire. And they'll start rattling off Nero and Vespasian and Domitian and Caligula. But the trick is then, where do you start your count of 10 and where do you end your count of 10? Because there were more than 10 emperors in Rome. And in any sequence of 10, persecution of the Christian church ebbed and flowed. It wasn't consistent at a consistently high level with every emperor. There were some at which it was very high, some at which it was almost non-existent. In most cases, it was predominantly localized in Rome. And so if you were a Christian living in another part of the Roman Empire, persecution would come less in the form of execution and you being put to death. It would come more in the form of you being blacklisted in your community, not being able to ply your trade, not being able to make a living, living in poverty, losing a lot of your money. It was persecution. It was just of a different variety. Persecution in Rome could take on much more brutal, violent, ending in death kind of persecutions. But all of this, there's a lot going on with the Greek Empire and the Roman Empire and their treatment of Israel that clearly is in John's mind as he's drawing on that this is part of the way the dragon makes war with the people of God is through people like Nero, people like Domitian, people like Antiochus Epiphanes, people like the Pharaoh of Egypt. People like Nebuchadnezzar, people like, why can I never remember the Assyrian king's name? Tiglath-Pileser III that destroyed the northern kingdoms. All these figures. John kind of has that in mind as he's calling on Daniel chapter 7. But again, the point of Daniel in the fiery furnace and in the lion's den and in these visions is to remind us that no matter what seems to be going on around here, God is sovereign over even the world empires. God is sovereign not just in the territory of Israel, but he's sovereign in Babylon, he's sovereign in Nineveh, he is sovereign in Athens, he is sovereign in Rome, he is sovereign over all seasons and all times and places. So, I don't know if that helps us with Daniel 7 or not. It adds another piece to the puzzle. If we're going to understand Revelation 12, we at least need to factor in Daniel 7. Back to Revelation 12. 1 through 6, the characters are introduced. The Son is born and snatched up to heaven. Hardly a mention, nary a mention of his work. He's born and he is snatched away. The woman flees into the desert to a place prepared for her by God. War in heavens. And then verse 10. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, and we have a little hymn. Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ. It's important language because remember the depiction of the dragon that was given. We have both authority and power not used in words but in pictures with horns and crowns and heads. And in this hymn it says, now comes the salvation and power and kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ. In obvious contrast to the image of the dragon from earlier. For the accuser of our brothers, who accuses them before our God day and night, has been hurled down. They overcame him, and this is very important, and this is I noted this on the handout, the three means by which the dragon was overcome. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb, and by the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death. The blood of the Lamb, the word of their testimony, and their willingness to sacrifice their own lives. Therefore, rejoice, you heavens, and you who dwell in them, but woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you, and he is filled with fury, because he knows that his time is short. He knows that his time is short. The whole dispensational model of trying to line up all the pieces in a neat order, I really do not like. But one of its most persuasive parts of the book is here in the 7-year tribulation for 3.5, maybe the people of God are here for 3.5 years protected and then snatched away, and the dragon is making war intensely with them. It's a little cleaner than some of the other places where the dispensational model is used, but a lot of it's predicated on this. The dragon is filled with fury because he knows that his time is short. And we know from the letters of Paul, from earlier in Revelation, Jesus is coming soon. This language of imminence is used throughout the New Testament, that the time is nigh. And yet, we have to be careful that we don't judge short and soon in terms that mean short and soon to us, because clearly we're working towards 2,000 years, give or take, since the death of Jesus, and the church is still going. And so whatever short means, whatever soon means, I had a conversation just a week or two ago about the nature of the timing of the writings of the Gospels. I said, why did the apostles wait so long? They waited 30, 40 years after the events of Jesus' life before they started writing things down. And while the answer may be more complicated than this, the simple answer is they thought Jesus was coming back in their lifetime. There was no reason to write it down. Jesus had told them, I'm coming soon. Some of you will not die before you see me. Language like that. They thought it would happen in their lifetime. And every generation of Christians since then has thought the same. And as they started getting older, all of a sudden, you know, the disciples look around and they're in their 60s instead of in their 30s or their 20s. And they say, you know what? We might should write this stuff down for the next generation so these stories can go on in case this doesn't happen in our lifetime. Soon and short, we want that to mean it's imminent, but in heavenly terms, even Jesus would say, only God knows the time. Only God knows the time, and so we do not. So what does it mean that he's filled with fury because he knows that his time is short? What is short? I mean, in the grand scope of eternity, 2,000 years is pretty short. 3,000 years may be short in the scheme of eternity. It's not to us. I mean, that's a long time. But we're forced to wrestle with this dragon being hurled to the earth and making war with the rest of the offspring of the woman. Has that been taking place from the time of the writing of this, from the time of Jesus ascending into heaven, the dragon here making war with the followers of God? Or is this a moment yet to happen where the level of persecution will intensify? And I think you can make a case either way. It's typically been very easy for us in America as interpreters of the Bible to think of the great persecution that the war the dragon issues against the offspring of the woman to be future, in large part because we've lived in such a very comfortable and easy period of time to be Christians, a place and time. In today's day, with the media cycle getting a little bit bigger and broader, and we understand what's taking place in the lives of Christians in other parts of the world, we realize that tribulation exists now, and it always has, that persecution exists now. And back to your point, that the deception of the dragon keeping people in the dark clearly has been taking place for the better part of the last 2,000 years, ever since Christ's ascension into heaven. And so I tend to lean towards that idea that the heavenly war took place perhaps at the victory of Christ over death, one of those kinds of moments. Maybe what this was either Satan and his angels trying to reclaim their place in heaven and seeing the death of Jesus as an opportunity, or perhaps Satan was always in heaven as an agent of God serving some kind of role, but overstepped his bounds, perhaps in the Garden of Eden, or perhaps in the death of the Son of God, and that his fall from heaven took place at that moment of Christ's victory over death. Theories. I mean, we're guessing, and the Bible doesn't give us any more details, but I do think you have this heavenly war perhaps taking place around that great cosmic battle of Jesus' victory, and that Satan being thrown to the earth and trying to destroy the old covenant, the faithful Israel, the remnant Israel, failed in doing so. Israel still exists, and so he has made it his goal to make war with all of those who would call themselves followers of Jesus in whatever capacity he is able. And that seems to be what is being depicted here. And I think when you move into chapter 13 and we're introduced to the beast of the sea and the beast of the earth, what we find is that the dragon's strategy for making war with the people of God, we see that written throughout the last 2,000 years of history. That Satan would choose a monster that is oppressive, violent political entities, and he would also create a monster that is false belief, both within the community of God, but also other belief systems and ideas. That Satan has two strategies, oppressive government and false religion. And you can look at every juncture throughout the history of the church over the last 2,000 years, and even today, and see examples of how those two things deceive people, lead people astray, and make war with all who would call themselves followers of Jesus. So that is my personal synopsis. Take it with a grain of salt as you kind of read and come to your own conclusions. So 13 and 14 we'll look at next time we meet, which will be 2 weeks from tonight.